transferred the business to Champlain Valley Equipment. Ron, Butch, and everyone at LW Greenwood & Sons have been proud to supply high-quality brand-name equipment to rural Central Vermont families. It has been their privilege to serve many generations of loyal customers. They thank you for all the good years, strong friendships, and fond memories, wishing you all the best in the future.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A beautiful day today. Thanks for spending part of it with us. Coming up on the program, Congressman Peter Welch is in the house. So we'll welcome your phone calls for him, because I'm sure he'd much rather hear yours than mine this morning. You can reach us at 244, because we're going to talk about creamies. We're going to talk about, apparently, you were stealing candy the last time you were down in the lobby here.
I thought I got away with it.
Oh, all right. But the I guess it turns out those are actually dog biscuits, so I don't know what you actually did with them.
Well, they were tasty.
You'll do anything to get that canine vote, won't you? We're going to chat with the congressman about a variety of issues, but we would welcome your calls at 244-1777, and you can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good.
How long
Beautiful
are you home
day.
For?
Well, we go back several days after Labor Day, so we've been on recess during August, and it's been obviously fabulous to be in Vermont and not have to go back and forth to Washington.
Let's talk about your campaign. So why should people reelect you for 2 years? It's been a pretty dysfunctional place down there.
Well, it is dysfunctional. And in fact, I think that is the major challenge that this country has. The House of Representatives in particular cannot act on some of the major things that this country needs to act on, like infrastructure. You know, we didn't even have a long-term funding plan to repave our roads and fix our bridges.
Right.
Immigration reform. You know, after the defeat of Eric Cantor in his primary, any hope on the Republican side to stick their heads out to do something that the country needs, our farmers need here, our resort community needs here, our education system needs, that was off the table. And we all know we'd be better off with a long-term grand budget bargain, but we're not able to do that because of the dysfunction in Congress. What I've managed to do is bring kind of a Vermont way of doing business to Washington, where when you go below some of those top-line issues where there's just inveterate conflict, I can actually help get things done by standing up for things we care about in Vermont, but by reaching out and finding common ground with some of my Republican colleagues. And I'll give a couple of examples. The Farm Bill. I was a major participant in getting a Farm Bill passed that's been good in the farm-to-school program, really good for dairy, really good on nutrition. Irene funding, you know, that was not a slam dunk in the House, where I was a delegation of one in the minority party and not on any relevant committees. And we got a waiver in the House in significant part because of my relationships with some Republicans, including then Majority Leader Eric Cantor. So those are a couple of examples. The Gabriella Miller pediatric research bill. Greg Harper, a very conservative Republican from Mississippi, and I co-sponsored it. It took money away from the political conventions that taxpayers have been providing, Republican and Democrat, and instead we put that money into cancer research at NIH. And we had a bill signing ceremony with Eric Cantor in the president's office. So I found ways where, instead of just focusing on the differences, I find common ground and make some progress. And that's the kind of leadership I think that the country needs. It's sort of what we do automatically here in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
So when I do it in Washington, there, it's like a big deal. Here, it's what we do. And I think that's what this Congress needs if it's going to get back on track.
So it's just going to do it incrementally, one small brick at a time.
Well, there's got to be trust building. And, you know, there's nothing that gets done. I saw this when I was in Montpelier. Nothing that gets done of real significance unless at the end of the day you can do it together. And that means there's got to be some bipartisanship. And there's room for a person who can be bipartisanship to be a full-throated Republican conservative or Democratic liberal. Ted Kennedy was an example. You know, he died about 5 years ago yesterday. And nobody was more of a strong liberal lion than Ted Kennedy, but nobody did more to reach out to the other side to get things done than Ted Kennedy. Orrin Hatch is a very conservative Republican, but he's somebody that worked oftentimes with Ted Kennedy to get things done. And, you know, Vermonters understand that. And I'm trying to bring that Vermont approach to Washington.
So how do you change? But how do you change the leadership? I mean, you know, as you say, you're a little bit further down the food chain here. And how do you get these people at the top? I mean, how do you get to a point where it's a win-win for everybody?
Well, you know, I think some of the problems are outside of Congress and some are in. The gerrymandering that has happened with our congressional districts is literally squeezing the democracy out of the House of Representatives. Because we've had state houses that have designed these boutique districts for the benefit of the politicians and the parties. And they're super conservative or sometimes super liberal. And it means that the people in those districts are worried only about a primary where what they're threatened by is the most liberal or the most conservative wing of their party. You know, I'm a co-sponsor of legislation that would have impartial, neutral commissions establish congressional districts. We do that in Iowa. We do it in California. And there's been a significant improvement in the competition in those races. So I think that's incredibly important and would be really good for the country and for Congress. And second, the money in politics is just brutal now. You know, when I first ran in 06 with Martha Rainville, very competitive race, highly qualified candidate, she and I made an agreement between us, a handshake, that we wouldn't run negative ads against each other. And we were so insistent on that that the Republican Committee and Democratic Committee didn't do that. Now, since Citizens United, when you have these outside groups, outside billionaires, that can pick any district to try to make a point they care about, but the people in Vermont, say, could care less about, they can flood the airwaves with anything they want. And the candidate almost becomes secondary because they don't control their own message. So that's been a real corrupting influence, in my view, on the process. So the money post-Citizens United and the gerrymandering, I think, are two external forces that are compromising the democratic aspirations of people in our individual districts.
Talking to Congressman Peter Welch, do you think there's any chance that commission idea could be extended nationwide?
I do. I mean, I think it won't be with this Republican majority, with Mr. Boehner. He's against it. And, you know, nothing gets put on the floor unless he agrees to it. But I'm finding more and more, for instance, among my Republican colleagues where this is much more of a problem. I mean, think about it. Eric Cantor was not conservative enough in his district. And I know Eric Cantor, and he's plenty conservative. So there's a lot of my Republican colleagues who are thinking this is getting a bit out of hand. Because at the end of the day, they'd actually feel a lot better if we were getting things done. Because a lot of them, even though they're from conservative districts, they hear the same thing I hear from Vermonters, which is, Peter, why don't you guys get together and get something done? So we may be, let's hope we're moving towards a tipping point. But I think each of us, and this is an opportunity I've had because of Vermonters supporting this kind of approach, each of us doing the best we can to reach out, and then also to try to propose reforms that would make it strong and durable for us to work together.
You're again, though, this year going to be in an election that I would argue is going to be pretty uncompetitive.
Well, we'll see. We'll see who's going to be running. But, you know, competitive or not competitive, the voters are going to decide that. My job is to do my job. And my job in the campaign season is to get out and answer questions people ask me, as you did right at the beginning. Why? Why should you go back? What have you done? What are you proposing? And this is an opportunity for me to work as hard as I've always worked. You know, we do these Congress in your communities. I'm back virtually every weekend. Basically, my approach in Washington is to drive is an effort to bring the Vermont way of doing business to Washington. And I think it's been really successful for achieving certain things that are important to Vermonters. You know, we've got that top-level dysfunction where the leadership can't get together on those things that are really important, like infrastructure and immigration. But there's a lot of things that I mentioned and others where we've been able to make progress and where that model of reaching out and finding common ground as opposed to just looking for conflict is more important than ever.
Let's talk about some of the issues the president's been facing these days. My goodness. So when I mention Ferguson, Missouri, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Well, heartbreak for that family. I mean, this is a young man who is going to be going to school, who is walking in the middle of the street in the middle of the day, and in a moment, he is dead with six bullet shots in his body, including one through the top of his head. I mean, how can you not have enormous heartache for him and his family? So that's my initial reaction. And then, of course, that community is now really torn apart about what happened, about the police tactics, about what really did happen, and what was the basis for the officer to do this. And we don't even know. There's no information that's coming out, so everyone is left to wonder and think the worst. I mean, the best hope is that we're going to have some reexamination in a lot of our police departments about police tactics. You know, in Vermont, in fact, I've been talking to Chief Baker from Rutland, Chief Sherling from Burlington, and Commissioner Flynn, just to get their take on this question of military equipment.
Yep.
And, you know, the big point they make is that you've got to have community policing where the police are establishing relationships and building trust in the community before something bad happens. And that the equipment issue is really important, obviously. And you, when you have a peaceful protest, you don't show up in Humvees, you know, in high-powered rifles. So a lot of this is the judgment of the police and the commitment that the police department has to building trust within the community. The Ferguson Police Department is in an African-American community and has very, very few African-Americans on the police force, and there's no indication that they've embraced a kind of community policing approach that I think is widespread here in Vermont.
Do you think this militarization of police departments has created negatives?
Yeah, it has. Again,
you do anything about it?
Well, we are. We're going to be reexamining it when we get back to Washington, and I think we should. And that's why I was consulting with our police leaders here, because they made a good point. Like, for instance, by the way, we have some heavy equipment, a couple of big Humvee-type vehicles, but they're under the control of the state police, and they do have some dual-use purposes. So they can be used in a civilian situation, maybe Irene. But if there, God forbid, were a really terrible situation with a lot of firepower being directed at innocent civilians or the police, they would have the equipment that in that particular circumstance might make sense. But again, Vermont did this right, and I credit Governor Jim Douglas and former Commissioner Kerry Sleeper, because after 9/11, when Homeland Security had all that money and was distributing a lot of heavy equipment to local police departments, Governor Douglas and Commissioner Sleeper said, hey, we can't have all our small police departments having Humvees. If we're going to have anything, it should be under the control of the state police. There have to be protocols about when and where this would be appropriate to use. There'd have to be highly trained people. And then if there's a local situation, then they rely on the state police to provide that asset in that particular situation. So that was a wise decision by the governor and by Commissioner Sleeper. Now, around the country, there was a big competition to get all of this equipment. It became a status symbol. When I was talking to Chief Baker, he's the one who told me about what Governor Douglas and Commissioner Sleeper did. He said, you know, if it was in the Wild West days, where it was like in a lot of, they would have had a huge speedboat that they wouldn't have been able to use except on the Otter Creek.
Right.
But so, you know, there's a proper way to do this. The other thing Chief Sherling indicated to me was, if any community police department is going to get certain equipment, they have to be trained for it. You can't just get it because you can. There have to be protocols and proper training and personnel who's going to know when and where how to use it, so you make proper tactical decisions.
There are people that are comparing what's happening out in Missouri to the civil rights movement, saying this is really sort of civil rights movement 50 years later. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I think what's a fair characterization is that we still have racial conflict in this country. And in that, those issues came out in Ferguson. I mean, the community there is asking a pretty reasonable question. Why was a young man walking in the middle of the street in the middle of the day shot dead? And we don't know the answer to that. But that's a pretty. It was a white officer and a black victim, African American victim. So, you know, those racial issues are. We've made a lot of progress on race in this country, but we're not where we want to be.
244-1777 is our local number in Central Vermont. Toll-free 877-291-8255. What should President Obama do about this fundamentalist group, ISIS?
Well, there's collective revulsion in Congress, as there is in our country, at ISIS, in that absolutely horrendous beheading of Mr. Foley. So it makes you want to do anything and everything to them. But I think the president's restraint on this and seriousness of purpose has been good. First thing is that he did have military strikes in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area. It had the limited objective, which was successful, to provide safe passage for the Yazidis who faced genocide. Secondly, it allowed us to protect Americans who were in Erbil, the Kurdish capital. I supported that. Now, there's two reasons. One, international law allows countries to take military action to stop genocide. And two, we've got to protect our own people. But there was another issue that was really quite important. In the case of Kurdistan, what we had on the ground is something we don't have in Baghdad. We had a competent government that's been a reliable ally, and they have a competent military, the Peshmerga. So you actually had a situation where air power could be followed up with ground forces that would provide intelligence but also help in providing that safe passage. And if we move beyond this to, because ISIS is so terrible, to extending a bombing mission in Iraq and even into Syria, in my view, that would require congressional action. And it raises many, many questions, not so much about the legitimacy of force if that could be used to deal with ISIS, but the practicality of it and whether we'd be dragged into yet another war in the Middle East.
So how would you vote on that today?
Well, I'm skeptical. I mean, obviously the president hasn't made that recommendation yet, but I've been very clear that I'm pretty skeptical. If we're bombing in Syria, what's the goal? Is it for us to intervene in the civil war? And the irony of it is that if we're getting involved in the Syrian civil war, focusing our efforts on ISIS, we're now putting ourselves almost in alliance with Assad. And ISIS is horrible. And everyone has seared in the front of their brain that image of that killer about to behead Mr. Foley. But you know what? Bashar al-Assad has created a mountain of bodies of his own people. I mean, he has tortured, he has killed, he has done random bombing with these barrel bombs in civilian areas, killed women and children. So it's not a great bunch of folks over there. And this is a Sunni-Shia conflict that has origins in the centuries. And we, in my view, have to be very careful about committing the U.S. to getting in the middle of that.
There are some European countries that negotiate with ISIS for the release of their captives, and the United States and Great Britain don't. Are the United States and Russia and Great Britain wrong to not negotiate?
You know, I don't see how the president can be negotiating ransoms when that ends up providing substantial A, incentive, and B, funding for these terrorist groups that we're adamantly opposed to. So, no, I support the ransom, no negotiation policy.
Dean Corn yesterday in the primary was seeking to get the Democratic nomination to run for lieutenant governor. Were you going to support him?
Well, it's up to the voters. If he gets the Democratic nomination, then I support the Democrats. But he's running as an independent.
And he's running as a proc.
He's running as a progressive.
And he also wants a Democratic nomination.
Right.
So if he gets the Democratic nomination, you'll support him?
I would support the Democratic nominee. If Dean Corn is it, I will support him.
Okay. Even though Phil Scott's, I'm assuming, probably a friend.
You know what? Phil Scott is a friend, and I've worked with him and served with him on the Transportation Committee with Senator Mazza. In fact, on that committee, in 1 year, Governor Shumlin served on it, I served on it, and Phil Scott served on it. And we all survived Dick Mazza. So we've got a solid bond.
I was going to remind you that Dick Mazza is now publicly supported Phil Scott.
Oh, they're so close. I mean, you know, they're wonderful, wonderful friends, and they've been together for years. And Dick was the, as you know, chair of the committee, and Phil served as vice chair. So, no, they're very, very close friends. And, you know, I like it that the two of them find a continuing place for friendship in politics.
Let's go to Montpelier. Dick, good morning.
Good morning. Question for Peter. Peter, twice you've described the Ferguson situation as a young man walking down the street in the middle of the daytime and is shot by the police. And I'm wondering if the information we're getting on the news is not true, and that they show video of him robbing a store. There's potential that he's reached into a car and tried to get a gun and punched a policeman. Your description seems pretty one-sided compared to what we're hearing on the news.
You know, that robbery story, I think, got pretty well debunked. Dick?
Yeah, okay.
Right. Well, anyway. Let me concede a point. None of us know what the full story is. We just don't know. So what the police officer, what actually happened, we don't know. And that's why I think it's absolutely essential that there be this exhaustive, independent investigation that's by the FBI, where every witness is interviewed, and there's going to be conflicts there, but the forensic evidence is carefully reviewed. So we don't know. And I told part of the story that was the obvious, and that is it's an unusual situation where the confrontation starts over jaywalking. And what happened after that, who knows? And it was in the middle of the day as opposed to one of those nighttime situations that are oftentimes much more fraught with anxiety all around. But if your point is that we don't know, you're correct.
Thank you for your call. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's talk a little bit more about this money in politics. You know, I got to tell you, I'm really sick and tired of people saying it's a big problem, it's corrupting the system, and then it just kind of continues on and on. I mean, you know, I'm not going to lay this all on you, but people like you have been talking about this for 6, 8, 10 years, and it's gotten worse.
It has gotten worse, and it's largely a function, I think, of a Supreme Court that doesn't get it when it comes to, quote, personhood. You know, if the Supreme Court... First of all, step back. Vermont passed significant campaign finance reform.
Yeah.
It put limitations on contributions, and then it did something that I thought was absolutely essential. It put a limitation on how much you could spend in a campaign. And that's actually, I think, the heart of where we ultimately have to go. That case was thrown out by the United States Supreme Court. They rejected it. Then you had Citizens United, where the Supreme Court literally, in what I think is a completely crackpot conclusion, said a corporation is a person like you and me. You know, a corporation has rights. They're entitled to legal protection. But a corporation is not a person. You know, and the Supreme Court seems to get it wrong on personhood. You know, in 1857, the United States Supreme Court said an African American was not a person.
Right.
And a corporation... You know, in
or three-fifths at one point, yeah.
Yeah, so they get it wrong. And that really puts handcuffs on the ability of legislators, including Congress, to pass a law that's going to pass muster by the Supreme Court. That Citizens United decision was 5-4. So, you know, the two things that folks are promoting, one is a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. Bernie's got one in the Senate, and I support one in the House. I'm co-sponsor. But frankly, that's a stretch. You know, I'm doing it, but do I think it's going to pass? I don't think it will. But the other that's potentially more likely is you get a new Supreme Court. Instead of having it a 5-4 decision saying corporations are persons, you get a 5-4 decision saying that corporations are corporations. So I think this is ultimately going to have to be something that is resolved by the courts.
But even if Citizens United got overturned, things were really heading in the wrong direction before that anyway.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I do support public financing and limitations on spending. And in some cases, you've seen where it's been productive. Like in Maine, they have a good state program. New York City has a pretty good program. So there are things that can be done. And ultimately, there's going to have to be a lot more public support around the country. I think in Vermont, there is support for limiting campaign spending. And we've elected members of the legislature who supported it legislatively, only to have the Supreme Court thwart it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have folks in other parts of the country telling their members of Congress, hey, get real, you know, act.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about health care for a few minutes here. Vermont here has been having difficulties with the health care website, the Vermont Health Connect. What are your fellow Congress people telling you their experiences are back in their state?
Well, it's mixed. But here's what my observations are. There's the mechanical and technical issues of the federal website with various state websites. Kentucky's doing really well. Other states, and Vermont has had its struggles. Those obviously have to be fixed. And what's alarming to people like me who support the health care law is that to the extent you have disruptions as a result of the computers and the mechanics and the signing up, it starts to undercut confidence in the program itself, even though the program may be good. If the administration of it isn't working as well as it needs to, then that's going to create hassles. So we've got to get that right. And I know Governor Shumlin is all over that. He understands that better than anybody. But what we have seen with health care is that the overall increase in the cost of health care overall is slowing. You know, it had been going up 2 and 3 times the rate of inflation. Also, we've seen that the access to health care has increased. Now, Vermont has always had a pretty good record on access, so other states have seen significant improvements. Now, the focus should be, in my view, in Congress, on coming up with practical ways to address some of the fixes that we need to make in the health care bill so that the system can work better and cost less. And that's why I'm working, for instance, with Ron Wyden and Johnny Isaacson in the Senate, Republican and Democrat and Republican, and Eric Paulson, Minnesota Republican in the House. And the first bipartisan bill that's focused on reform as opposed to repeal, and this is something that would take the blueprint for health, again, something that started under Governor Douglas, and have those principles applied to our Medicare seniors. And if it works, it could save about $2,200 per Medicare beneficiary.
Per year?
Per year.
Let's go to Burlington. Pat, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
Listen, I have an issue which might be perceived to be very small, and it is in the great scheme of things, and it has to do with Medicare and the premiums which are applied to Part B and the prescription drug coverage. And this is for people who earn more than $83,000 or $85,000 a year. It's discriminatory towards single people. Just as an example, if you're a single person and you make $85,000 or more, you have to pay a $42 additional premium for basically Medicare, and for prescription drug coverage, $12.10. If you're married, you don't have to pay this additional premium until your household income goes to $170,000. At that time, you start paying $42, which is what the single person paid at the $85,000 level. And by the time that this married couple gets there, the single person is now paying $167.80 additionally for their premium. And it makes no sense to me, especially since a married couple is going to use twice as much of the health care system than the single person is. And I've asked an actuary to kind of, you know, tell me what he thought, and he said he could not come up with any logical explanation mm-hmm. for it, except maybe there was a political reason, you know, why it was established like this to begin with.
So you thought you'd call a politician?
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, I did call your office, Congressman, last year, I think it was, and spoke to someone about this because I've been concerned about it. And, you know, it's a small thing, and, you know, they say the devil is in the details. But for me, it's a question of, you know, a fairness. And also, the federal government is missing probably many millions of dollars and not, you know, fairly applying this.
Okay. Let me see what the congressman has to say. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you for filling me in on that. I did not have the details, or I'm not aware oftentimes of the very specific cost-sharing formulas that that you're talking about. So I don't have an answer for you. I do know that the Medicare Part D program is largely taxpayer-funded, but also has contributions from Part D participants like you. And I would imagine that if we talked to someone from CMS, they would explain that the design of the formula is intended to try to make the program solvent. And you're outlining some element of it that you regard as discriminatory, and it may well be. And there's probably a variety of other aspects of it that may be subject to debate. So this is a long way of saying I don't have an answer to your question, and I'll look into it.
The changes you want to make in the federal health care bill are what?
With the blueprint for health provisions.
Okay, so you want to add that in. Anything else?
Well,
you're saying that there are fixes you wanted to make to the health care bill.
What I've been suggesting, the big challenge we have is we got to bring down the cost of health care in this country. That's really the challenge. And right now, what we're seeing is that our hospital administrators, our docs, are having to contend in the real world with Obamacare. And there's some good things and some bad things. And what I've been encouraging the Congress to do is to really be all ears when it comes to talking to our small employers, how's it working for you, to our hospital administrators, what are the things we can do to make it work better. So, frankly, I think that we should be in listening mode, and what we've been in is attack mode. You know, in the last 2 years, the House of Representatives has voted 55 times to repeal health care. Well, that's not going to happen. And it's not even a repeal with any kind of replacement. So what I found promising about this bill I'm working on a bipartisan basis that's intended to make in a small area, but a significant area, a reform, is that it's the first time we're looking to improvement as opposed to this, I think, dead-end approach on a repeal. So the specifics, you know, areas where I want to see us make a lot more progress are on prescription drugs. We've got to bring down the cost of that. We should be doing bulk price discounts. We should be negotiating prices on discounts. Secondly, with respect to hospital physicians or general practitioners, we've got to do a lot more in our healthcare in our medical education system to make incentives for young doctors to go into primary care. That's an urgent need that's for Americans, but it's also we're experiencing real shortages in Vermont and around the country.
But, you know, like this bulk price discount stuff, that's exactly the kind of stuff that never happens in Congress because the pharmaceutical companies give so much money to you guys that you won't do anything about it.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's a connection there. And we pay the highest prescription drug prices in the world. But, you know, we do have bulk price discounts for the VA. You know, if you get the same drug in the VA program that you get in the Medicare program, in the VA, it might cost 50% what it cost in Medicare, in some cases even lower. And that was a result of Congress, under Tom DeLay, when this was passed in the Bush administration, writing into the law that the Medicare program could not do bulk price discounts. And that is totally crackpot. I mean, that would be like you going in to buy 100 aspirin. And them charging you as though you were buying 100 single aspirins instead of getting the benefit of buying in bulk.
Mm-hmm. So if that were put out there as a piece of legislation and people passed it, so what would happen?
If Medicare could do bulk price negotiations?
Yeah, what would happen? What would the pharmaceutical companies do? What's everybody so afraid of?
Well, I agree with Mark. I agree with you. I've been the sponsor of this bill. And, you know, we've got to pay for our medication. It's not free.
Well, I can't haul your other 434 friends in here, so I'm sorry. You're going to have to
answer the questions. You know what? I think that if we put that on the floor and we passed it, Congress would be threatened with an improvement in its credibility among the American people. There's a lot of things that if we just put them on the floor, they'd pass. I think it'd be very tough for Tea Party members of Congress to vote against a bill that would lower prescription drugs for, like, that caller who just called in. All right. If we put an immigration bill on the floor, like the Senate bill that was passed on a strong bipartisan basis, it would pass. On the transportation bill, you know, I voted against the transportation bill.
I know you did.
And I was just so frustrated that all we did was come up with this temporary funding through next April when we know potholes don't fix themselves. And the funding program we had was bogus. You know, we it's called pension smoothing, where we give a break to the corporations so they don't have to fully fund their pensions. And the theory is then we can tax them more because they have higher revenues. So we create...
Unless they're Tim Hortons, you know, Burger King.
Well,
you know.
Exactly. So, you know, you can't make this stuff up. So then we create a pothole in somebody's future pension to fix a pothole in the highway through April. So, you know, what I said is, look, we may have to pass a gas tax. We have to pass some kind of revenue measure because potholes don't fix themselves. So, you know, I was amazed at that. But my view is that if we had put a bill on the floor with a serious revenue measure for the transportation fund, it would have passed. I mean, Mr. Schuster, who's the Republican chair of the committee, he would have supported it. He was advocating for it. But this is where it's really tough on the Republican side because there's a lot of folks in Mr. Boehner's party that won't vote for any revenue measure, no matter what, even when it's for the transportation fund. And we'd be much better off in Congress if instead of following this rule that he is following, that he won't put something on the floor unless it can pass with Republican votes. That means two things. One, Democrats aren't even in the discussion. And number two, the most conservative and extreme Republicans get to decide what the ultimate terms are. And those don't represent what most Americans want or need.
So it's basically up to three people, maybe four or five, who decide if a piece of legislation actually gets voted on.
That's right. And, you know, the couple of times where Mr. Boehner has deviated from that Republican rule that it has to be Republican votes, the Violence Against Women Act, avoiding a government shutdown, and the debt default, where he put it on the floor, it passed with overwhelming majorities. It had almost all Democrats, and it had about a third of Republicans. And then another third of the Republicans were voting no, but hoping yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Hyde Park. Ken, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Congressman, one of the things that has driven up the cost of medical care and that I never hear talked about was the campaign by the American Medical Association in the 60s and into the 70s. Actually, it started in the 50s, to restrict the number of doctors, to restrict the use of, we'll call it doctor alternatives, physician assistants, et cetera, to cut down the enrollment in medical schools and the growth in the enrollment. It was a very conscious campaign. It was a very effective campaign. So we end up with half the number of doctors. We end up with doctors making twice as much as they do in Europe. We end up with nine of the top 10 professions in Vermont by average income being physicians. Why don't we hear anything about the possibility of increasing the number of doctors by expanding medical schools and by allowing non-physician alternatives?
Okay, so Ken, help me out here. Who is behind this effort to limit the doctors?
Oh, my God. The American Medical Association, which ruled medicine into the 70s, it actually lost a lot of its following among the medical professions
I just wasn't clear who it was. Thank you for your call.
I don't know the details about the history like you appear to, but there's a good point about licensing in general, not just with respect to doctors, but other professions. And there's a tug of war on that. Because licensing is important to assure quality and the person that is treating us has adequate education and training. On the other hand, sometimes licensing becomes a roadblock to competent people being able to do the job. And how do you get the balance right? And I think the point you're making is that we've got to really be examining that. What is happening now is that you're definitely right. We don't have enough primary care physicians. By the way, they don't get paid a lot. You know, some of the specialists are doing really, really well. And it is a function in part of the reimbursement system that has rewarded the specialized procedures at the expense to some extent of the primary care providers. But we're also seeing a lot of pressure for physician assistants, nurse practitioners to play an increasing role in the delivery of health care. So you've got a point, and this licensing issue, I think, is part of something that if we were working on a bipartisan basis, we try to get a better balance than we have right now.
I want to go back to, I mentioned the Tim Horton Burger King thing. The Burger King has bought Tim Horton and is talking about moving its headquarters to Canada, where the corporate tax rate's about half of what it is in the United States. Should the United States lower its corporate tax rate to deal with this?
No. What it should do is stop these inversions, as they're called. I mean, when you have a company, a lot of the drug companies are doing this, where they just buy a small Irish drug company and then claim they are now in Ireland, even though they have 80% of their shareholders here, 90% of their workers here, and they avoid corporate taxes here. That's a ripoff, in my view.
Well, how do they get away with that? I mean, they're obviously still doing business in the United States. Why can't there be a distinction between the business they're doing here and the business they're doing other places?
Well, you're right. It's the law right now. Right now, if it's like you can do an inversion, apparently, under the law, if only 20, if you are, even if you're doing 80% of your business here, if you're doing 85, then I think you can't do the inversion. So I'm sponsoring legislation.
God, how did that happen? I mean, how did that happen?
You know what? I don't know the history on that, but I know it's outrageous. So what I'm supporting.
I mean, I don't mean to interrupt you, but if you had a company here in the state of Vermont, mm-hmm. that was located here, and they were doing that with New Hampshire, they couldn't get away with that within the United States, could they?
No, they could not, because every state, with respect to the state corporate income
yeah.
tax, is able to assess its tax on the basis of the portion of revenues that are generated in that state,
okay.
which is a sensible rule.
So okay? why can't, and why hasn't this been done on a international federal level? I don't get this.
Well, I don't have any excuse for that. You know, the fact is that corporations, this is a new phenomenon. I mean, it's only been happening, as I understand it, in the last couple of years. And Congress now could take action. And there's legislation sponsored by Senator Levin, Congressman Levin in the Senate, or in the House, and a number of senators, that would change the current law that is allowing this to happen by saying.
So there was a law that was passed somewhat recently that changed this, which allowed it because these new trends, or somebody just discovered it?
I don't know that. Here's what you know, is if there's a way to avoid taxes legally, then corporations and lawyers are going to figure out how to do it. I think what's happening now is that there is much more acceleration in merger in acquisition activity, and it's partly because the economy is getting better at the top end for the corporations, not for everyday people. So there's maybe some financial incentives for them to do that.
But something changed, because there were mergers like crazy in the 80s and 90s.
I don't know the history, Mark. I'll look into it. What I know is it's outrageous, and what we need in order to stop it is this legislation that would at least have the 50% rule. In other words, if 50% of the shareholders are in the U.S., and that's certainly the case in most of these situations, then that's a U.S. corporation subject to U.S. taxes.
So do companies that located in the U.S. and do business in foreign countries, they don't get taxed in the foreign countries? They just get paying taxes here?
Well, if you get, I think you get taxed if you do business in a foreign country, then sort of like a state-to-state situation that you described me before, you can get taxed on those revenues there.
So we get nothing. We get to talk about the short end of the stick on that deal.
Well, we're getting stiffed. There's two tax provisions in our code that are absolutely indefensible in my view. One is allowing these inversions where corporations can continue doing business and act today like they were yesterday, but not pay any taxes because they've set up shop in Ireland or the Cayman Islands. That's totally indefensible because those corporations are getting the full benefit of the United States government, whatever it is, including our military defense. The second one that's outrageous is the so-called carried interest, which I think you've talked about before, where the Warren Buffetts of the world pay a lower tax rate than their secretaries and their chauffeurs. And Warren Buffett's even against that.
Right. You're not going to Burger King anymore, are you?
No, I'm going to be
boycott?
Wendy's.
You're going to boycott?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Yes.
Okay, roll the tape. And I'm giving you Vermont Coffee Company coffee to leave with you. That is not Tim Horton's coffee you brought in here, is it? In that cup there?
No, this was down at the bagel shop.
Okay, let's go to Berlin. Steve, good morning.
Green Mountain Coffee.
Yes. This is very interesting. I have a rare skin disease, and we wanted to try a new ointment. Now, it's no cure, but it would slow down the itching, which I've, had for 54 years, and I have 24/7. But the insurance company turned me down, and the reason was that the medication costs $1,300, which is crazy to me. It's not so much the insurance company's fault, is that there's no reason that medications of any kind should cost that much.
That is expensive.
I've had another one with $1,600, but that was a few years back, and they did finally approve that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
I mean, it's made it hard for me. When I was younger, it made it very hard for me to work because of the odor it had, because it's a very rare skin disease. It's called Derrier's, and it's very rare. And it just seems something should be done,
All right, let me have Congressman comment. Thanks.
Well, I'm very sorry about that, and it's got to be incredibly frustrating for you, especially when it's a somewhat rare condition that's almost unique to you. There's two questions there. One is, why does it cost so much? And Mark and I were talking a little bit earlier about the lack of price negotiation, and you may be part of being a victim of that. There's some other medications that apparently are effective, but they cost like $80,000 a year. And if you have things that are priced so high that people who need them can no way afford them, then you don't have medication. So I really feel badly for you about that. The second question is always a tough question about whether the medication that an individual wants is established to be medically effective. And then that gets into the question of the determination of whether or not it'll be paid for. And that's a case-by-case situation. So anyway, I wish you the best on that, but I'm really sorry about your situation.
Let me take one more call here for you. Let's go to Hyde Park. Mac, good morning.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great. How you doing?
Good. Hey, don't you think that it makes any difference that the taxes in Canada are half of what the corporate taxes are here? I mean, how are our businesses supposed to compete? And how are our workers supposed to have a job if corporate taxes are so much lower in other countries? And then a second point that I'd like to make is that Vermont politicians are in the habit of making the case that somehow we're very special in Vermont because we work in a bipartisan way, but the legislature is overwhelmingly Democrat, and so I don't really understand that.
I think the political nature
of the rest of the country more accurately portrays the mixture of Republicans and Democrats, so it isn't that Vermont is special. The Democrats have a majority in which they can do whatever they want.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, two things. I want to talk about the corporate tax. Corporate profits in this country have never been higher. They have never been higher. But the average worker has not had a raise in 10 to 15 years. So profits are up. So this is not taxes in the U.S., corporate taxes in the U.S. are not affecting corporations and their ability to generate immense profit. So, I don't buy that. Our corporations are doing well. Our workers aren't. And in fact, there was a moment when the market hit its record high. Corporate profits were never higher. But workers' percentage of the income that was generated in corporations through their work was never lower. It went back to the Depression. So my view, corporations got to pay their fair share. And chasing the lowest cost is just going to mean it's tough on workers. It's going to be tough on our education system. And I think these inversions got to be stopped. Secondly, right now, Vermont does have a strong Democratic majority, as you mentioned. But if you notice, in Vermont, we do something that you'd never think of doing in Washington. We have minority party members, Republican members, who chair committees. That doesn't happen in Washington. You know, I did that when I was Senate president. I had a big role in who is the chair of this or that committee. And we had a 23-7 majority, and we had three Republicans who chaired committees. And it was something I learned when I was in the minority. The Republicans in the Senate, when I was in the minority, they gave me good assignments. They made some Democrats chairs of committees, and it was because there was a view that, yeah, you got a majority, but that doesn't mean you're always right. And just because you have the votes to get something done doesn't mean it's good to get done. And in fact, we have to have an ability to listen to contrary points of view in an honest way and incorporate some of the wisdom that comes from the minority. Right now, Democrats are a majority, but we could be a minority. We were a minority when I was there. And I learned from folks like Bob Gannett and Art Gibb about how you work across party lines.
Let's go to Essex Junction. Rick, good morning.
Good morning, Mark, and good morning, Congressman Welch.
Good morning.
I don't really have a question, but Warren Buffett was mentioned a few minutes ago, and you also talked about the Burger King Tim Horton deal. And just as a point of information, according to some news items that I saw this morning, you know, Warren Buffett is, providing $3 billion to support the Burger King Tim Horton move. So, I just thought I'd mention that and see if there were any comments about it.
That's interesting.
No, I saw that. Yeah, and I think Warren Buffett's got some questions that he should answer about the inversion, if that's what they're going to do, because it certainly seems in conflict with a lot of what he said and done in the past.
Thank you for your call. Have you done the ice bucket challenge?
I haven't.
Have you been challenged?
I haven't yet, but I'm getting nervous.
Would you do it if you were challenged?
I'm
asking a serious question.
The answer is anything any of us can do for raising money, we probably should do. There's been an ethical committee. This is a bizarre thing in Congress about whether if members of Congress do this on congressional time, that's campaigning. So I'd actually literally have to find out whether this is something or how I could do this in a way that doesn't get me in trouble.
Like if it wasn't planned and somebody just came in here and just dumped it on you, wouldn't have time to really think about it. Something like that.
Do I see somebody out there in the hall with an ice bucket?
Well, no, but we'll let you leave. We'll leave your imagination to believe that.
And thank you.
Then you'll want to stay in here. No, thank you for coming in this morning. We appreciate it. So
thank you.
Congressman Peter Welch joining us here live in our studios. We'll take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to check in this morning with the Republican candidate for governor. We'll talk with Scott Millen coming up in just a moment.
Ruben and his team from RB Technologies on Route 14 in East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Marcia Curtis from Capital Steel.
He's our IT specialist. We go to him for everything that we need for the computer systems, our security systems, our perception monitoring. If we've got a question about our email, a computer, Windows, any kind of situation that we run into, we run to Ruben. Oh, his customer service is great, along with being extremely professional. They're very personable. It's not like somebody sitting in here and talking a bunch of computer speak to you. They actually listen. They answer your questions in English, which is really good. And they don't look at you like you're absolutely crazy. You know, when you say, my computer is making this really strange picture or whatever it's doing. And they always seem to come up with a solution. It's really great. It works really well for us.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
Very exciting news from Formula Ford. We've got a new sales director. He's Keith Higgs, and he's been... Oh, hold on.
Hello?
Oh, all right. Okay, apparently that's news, but not the news. The news is that Formula Ford has been authorized to get you into a brand new Taurus, Escape, Explorer, Edge, Fiesta, even the new C-Max. With 0% financing for 72 months. It's Formula's model year-end wipeout. And the savings to you are huge. So huge savings, huge selection on new Ford with 0% financing for 6 years. Right now at Formula... Hold on. I think I know what you're going to say. I got it. And the fact that Keith Higgs is our new sales manager is also big news. Get that man an official management sweater vest. As for you, get to Formula Ford soon, because these deals end Monday. Okay, that's a lie. They don't end Monday. Right on the roundabout at the junction of 302 and Route 2 in Montpelier. Online at FormulaFordVT.com. No one will work harder to earn your business.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here for news. We'll talk with Scott Milne just in a couple of minutes here. Keep your dial right here. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugarbush, FM 96.5 in Barrie and Montpelier, 101.9 in the Northeast Kingdom, and the flagship, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. We'd love to take your calls next hour at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255.